and she will be presenting on science-based decision-making in environment health for system review, got to do with it. And by saying that, this is our third paper, and the fourth paper will be introduced by my colleague, Emily. Thank you for that, and please remind the timing. I'll appreciate that. I got to catch my flight that has been moved up, so thanks for your understanding. And with all respect to the presenters and the audience, I need to leave. Okay. Now, it's Patrice Sutton is going to present science-based decision-making in environment health. What system review got to do with it?
Thanks. I will take it personal that you're leaving. Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here. And thank you for the other presentations. So I have no conflicts to declare. So I'm with the UCSF program on reproductive health and the environment, and our mission is to prevent toxic exposures to environmental chemicals. And we do that, we do basic research, and we have a very strong program to translate science into action. And so that leads us into one very big challenge, is that if your goal is to essentially change the healthcare system so that environmental health is recognized as part of health, which is why we're in the School of Medicine, the first thing you're up against is the fact that there are toxic chemicals in every single aspect of our lives, from the time you get up and half of you put on lipstick, whether you're cleaning your house, whether you're going to work, you're in your car, you're cooking food, there are toxic chemicals in our environment to the extent that chemicals in commerce, this is from 2012, were about 30,000 pounds a person in the United States. Now, of course, we know that those 30,000 pounds don't show up on everybody's doorstep equally, but we do have a large body of science that we're trying to essentially address. And from a standpoint of reproductive health, these chemicals do end up in people's bodies. This was a study that was done by my colleagues at UCSF, which used National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data, which is population-based, to basically determine that every pregnant woman in America has at least 43 toxic chemicals in her body. So the bottom line for our program is, how can we change the healthcare system to recognize that taking toxic chemicals out of pregnant women would be a very important public health goal? So that brings us to why we want to act on the science to prevent harm. The science is voluminous. There's often conflicting information in the science. It's very poorly understood by decision makers. So we're trying to make decision makers act on the science, and that's where this tool that I'm going to describe fits in. Because there's essentially a need for an evidence-based bottom line, not only in terms of understanding toxicity, but really the goal is that if we want to do things in a more healthful way so that we're not essentially designing our environments to be toxic, we need to know whether or not there are safer alternatives. So it's a way, when hazard assessment is kind of fundamental to making decisions about how we're going to shape our environment to support health. So in the clinical sciences, they've had this problem that they've addressed decades ago. You have all of this evidence, and how do you essentially, when a patient comes into your room, how do you essentially use that evidence to make a decision to protect patient health? And this is a study from 1992 that was published in JAMA, which was really a landmark study that looked at expert narrative reviews in the clinical sciences and compared it to what the actual systematic review, taking the science and putting it in meta-analyses and combining it in a timely fashion. What were the answers that experts writing in textbooks said versus what systematic reviews and meta-analyses said? And in fact, they found that not only were the experts recommending things that were not helpful, but sometimes they were recommending things that were harmful and even dangerous. And this led to a whole field in the clinical sciences of evidence-based medicine, which is essentially to apply the best evidence to decision-making in a timely manner. Because in environmental health, as you know, delays in decision-making are not a neutral policy choice. Delays in decision-making means that everyone is exposed while we're trying to figure out what does the science say to try to take the exposures away. So in the clinical sciences, there are two methods that are kind of sentinel in this regard. One is the Cochrane collaboration and the other one is GRADE. Has anyone ever heard of either one of these? There you go. Okay, so we kind of thought, okay, well, let's look at how do Cochrane and Grade work. This is a book by Dan Fox that was very instrumental. This is just to say that these methods of systematic and transparent reviews in the clinical sciences have now influenced decision-making about billions of dollars of healthcare spending. So how can we use these kinds of methods to influence decision-making in environmental health? So today, in environmental health, our systems are a predominantly expert-based narrative review, so you end up with a situation of this he said, she said. You have one expert up against another expert. But the problem we faced is that the methods that are used in Cochrane and Grade and these methods that have been developed in the clinical sciences are not directly transferable to environmental health for a couple of major reasons. So one is apparent on this chart, I can make this work. So if you look at this side of the graph, this is the clinical sciences. So this is, first of all, not to say that this method works perfectly in the clinical sciences, but nevertheless, if you're developing a new intervention, a new pharmaceutical, you have to test it for your preclinical studies before you allow the drug to be used in people. And then you do some human randomized controlled trials. So this means the clinical sciences are very used to human experimental evidence. Then the drug enters the marketplace and you look for post-exposure observational studies, because you know when you expose a very large population, even if you had a trial, you may have a different result. In environmental health, however, we have a very different decision context, because in environmental health in 1976, the Toxic Substances Control Act was passed, and that basically gave 62,000 chemicals in commerce a pass. So it said, well, you're okay, and then many thousands of chemicals have been put in commerce, mostly without testing subsequent to that time. So all of these chemicals enter the marketplace, enter your homes, enter your schools, enter all aspects of daily life, mostly without testing. And so then, in environmental health, we're in the position of saying, well, we have all this evidence. Have people gotten sick from this? So the burden of proof and the decision logic is very different, because in environmental health, we're trying to take an exposure away where there is no risk benefit, whereas in clinical sciences, they're trying to see if you can give person an exogenous chemical with a risk benefit decision logic. So while you ponder that, I just have to get a little more water. So in addition to a difference in decision logics, in environmental health sciences, we rely on animal evidence and other toxicological tests that are completely unfamiliar and not valued by the clinical sciences. This says your research is very promising, it's a shame you're afraid of mice. This is just to say that clinicians are really not used to looking to animal studies, but of course in environmental health sciences you can do a 2-year study on mice and find an answer that you might not be able to find in 20 or 30 years if you're just studying humans. So to address this, and beginning in 2009, we convened a whole group of experts to basically figure out how we could navigate the science in environmental health in a way that's kind of comparable to the clinical sciences. And this is a picture of our group. And there was a collaboration of 22 clinical environmental health sciences, a very interdisciplinary group that got together and developed the navigation guide. And this is just an overview of the method. And I'm going to go through steps 1, 2, and 3 to show you the case study. But in the meantime, step 4, which is hugely important, we have not had the resources developed. But that's where you take the hazard assessment that you've developed in the first steps and then apply values and preferences to your hazards. So in other words, much of the debate in environmental health is not about science at all. It's about policy options that relate to values and preferences. And particularly, let's say, if you're a community that might not value having a toxic waste site next to you, it may not be because you need to prove that that hazard is going to have a certain effect. So we haven't gotten to that part yet. But what I am going to just show you is an example that we developed proof of concept of the first 3 steps of the method. We looked at the question, does developmental exposure to perfluorinated PFOA, which is one of the chemicals that give water and grease resistance to things like fast food papers and pizza boxes and that type of thing, or your couch, if you think the coffee doesn't spill on it but just beads up, it's probably treated with PFOA. Anyway, so we looked at the question of fetal growth and PFOA, because Everybody in America and every pregnant woman virtually has PFOA in them. So exposure is ubiquitous. And there's evidence that it can affect fetal growth. That's a very important public health outcome. And so it has a lot of public health implications. So this is an overview of the method. And I'm going to rather quickly just point out that each step, the first step is a PICO question, which is just a way to develop, it's taken from, it means population exposure comparative and outcome. But it's really a way to get a well-defined question that you want to answer. And that's the step where you can then get all of the parties that might be impacted by the decision engaged in what is the question we really even want to ask. Then you do a systematic search of the literature, you select your studies, extract your data and data analysis, rate the quality of the evidence and the strength of the evidence. So what's important here, too, is that you have to do that for each evidence stream, and then you put the data together to reach an overall conclusion. So one of the main differences in using systematic methods in environmental health is that you write the rules of how you're going to look at the evidence before you do that. So you have a protocol. And I already explained, this is just the example of the PICO question for proof of concept here. But you have a comparable question for the animal studies. And then you do a systematic search of the evidence, and the idea is that then that's something somebody can reproduce. We looked at all languages and in the gray literature. And then you select your studies. So you have this literature search, and then you have explicit, predefined exclusion and inclusion criteria as what will be involved, what studies will go into your review. And this is the results from the PFOA case study. We ended up with about 6,000 studies that we captured in our search. But then when you take out the duplicates and things that didn't actually meet the inclusion and exclusion criteria, we ended up with 21 studies in the animal data and 18 studies in the human data, and then 7 studies, 8 data sets were we could use in meta-analysis on the animal data, and 9 for the human data. This is just to say that sometimes it's daunting. People say, oh, you started with 6,000 papers, but actually it's very efficient because you've already decided which papers will be in and out when you start. And this is just to show that it took about 2 weeks to screen the papers for the humans, and it was about comparable for the animal studies. So the next step is to extract the data. In the interest of time, I'll just say that we basically did double data extraction. We looked at summary plots, basically looking at the data raw to basically see if we could do a meta-analysis. This is the results of the meta-analysis for PFOA and birth weight in the non-human mammalian data. And you can see that for every decrement of 0.023 grams in birth weight, for every milligram per kilogram per day increase in PFOA exposure, you basically lowered birth weight. So the animal data, when you put it together, and if you kind of look at the meta-analysis, not all the studies, if you had looked at them one by one, would you have necessarily seen that. When you put the data together, meta-analysis is a strong tool for seeing what's actually the signal. And the human results really mirrored the animal results. So we similarly found the more PFOA you were exposed to, the lower the birth weight. So the next part that I'm going to talk about is kind of completely different than normal reviews in environmental health sciences. You have to rate the quality of individual studies, and then you rate the quality of the body of evidence. And one of the things that you might see sometimes in reviews is that 3 studies said this and 2 studies said that, but you don't really know where those 3 studies, you know, what was the quality of each of this. So this kind of gets to looking at actually what are the quality of the studies that went into the review. And the first thing that you do is look at risk of bias. Risk of bias is something that, for those of you who are epidemiologists, are something that you're already well familiar with, although we don't necessarily call it risk of bias in environmental health science, but it's essentially characteristics of a study that will systematically introduce an error in either the direction or the magnitude of the results. And so you take each study, and then these are just the domains that we used for the human studies. All of our domains for both the human risk of bias and the animal risk of bias were basically adapted from Cochrane and other methods that are out there. But you look at things that you would just normally do, but what it does is, so for example, you'd look at confounding, exposure assessment, conflict of interest. I will just mention conflict of interest is something that we include and think is extremely important. There's a very robust body of evidence in the clinical sciences that the funding source will influence the result that you get. That's controversial. Not everybody who is working on this topic has adopted conflict of interest. And then you decide, well, were each study low, high, probably high risk of bias, and there's definitions for all of that. But then after you rate the individual studies, you have to look at the whole body together. And once again, borrowed from how the grade system works, you basically start non-human evidence out as high quality evidence because it is experimental evidence, and in grade, they start human randomized experimental evidence out as high. Our human body of evidence in environmental health is observational studies, so for reasons that I could get into, we rated that moderate because it is not experimental data, which in environmental health is virtually precluded from the evidence stream for ethical reasons. So you start with either high or moderate, and then you have criteria that you look at, whether it's indirect, inconsistent, the precision, all of these issues, and you basically go up or down. So this is showing you just examples of the risk of bias across all studies. The top is for the human studies, the bottom is for the non-human mammalian studies. But you can see that we rated the risk of bias, green is obviously low risk, red is high risk. So in the animal studies, we uncovered the fact that there's a lot of experimental methods that are actually not commonly used in toxicology testing. And we just kind of walked into this issue, but as it turns out, in the preclinical sciences, in preclinical work in the clinical sciences, this is a very well-described problem. So we're relying on evidence in environmental health that's actually not generated in as robust a way than it could be. And then anecdotally, when we go out and talk about this, a lot of toxicologists, it doesn't seem to be the norm to actually use robust methods of blinding and allocation concealment and that type of thing. So for that reason, as I had mentioned, we started the humans as moderate, and we looked at all of these things systematically and ended up with a moderate rating on the human evidence in terms of quality. The non-human mammalian, we weren't happy about all of that noise and potential bias in the non-human mammalian data, so we went from high to moderate. Finally, you have to rate the strength of the evidence. We said, well, this is the non-human mammalian evidence. We had moderate quality evidence. We had a decrease in fetal growth of PFOA exposure. There were actually calculations done to see if a new study would change the effect that we saw. And then those criteria line up with a predefined definition of sufficient evidence of toxicity. The same thing we did for the human evidence. For similar reasons, we ended up with sufficient human and evidence. So then this last step is borrowed from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. When they make a decision about something that's known to be a carcinogen, they integrate. It's not quantitative. I really like this part. All you have to do is look sufficient and sufficient, and you have known to be toxic to human reproduction. So our conclusion was that, in fact, human exposure to PFOA is known to be toxic to human reproduction and development based on sufficient evidence of decreased fetal growth in both human and non-human mammalian species. Whoops. I have 2 minutes, I think. So this was just to compare our results. I just want to say the National Toxicology Program is moving very fast and furiously in adopting methods that mirror the navigation guide. This is just to show we looked at the existing PFOA reviews, and most of them did not meet any of the criteria for a systematic review. I will skip that. I'll just say that it works. It was rigorous, systematic, and transparent. We just published 4 papers in Environmental Health Sciences, which describe all the results that I've just given you in 18 minutes. And there's more case studies underway. We were challenged on our PFOA in the reviews because people had a mechanism that they suggested it was a hypothesis basically that it's actually having low birth weight, which increases your PFOA level. So we had to do a systematic review to actually show that there was not evidence for that. We're in preparation to, for a triclosan case study. We found that to be possibly toxic using the same method. We have two other case studies underway. So just in closing, I would just say that there were two reports by the National Academy of Sciences this year which recommended methods that systematic and transparent methods to the US EPA, particularly in their IRIS hazard assessments. I want to acknowledge not only because these are the team that did the work, but just to point out that it's an extremely interdisciplinary process. It's really not somebody sitting alone with someone else in their office. It's very robust engagement by toxicologists, epidemiologists, industrial hygienists even. And this is our funders, and that's it. Thank you.